article update. I'm just curious. Show of hands, how many of you, this is your first Judges program? Do we have no? I got one. One person who's new. All right. Well, this is kind of a staple of what we do, that we've been doing for the last decade or so on a regional Judges program, making sure that you're up to speed on developments in the world of case law and attorney general opinions. Let's also just have a moment of truth. I always love having a moment of truth out here as we get to the last school of the year. How many of you are here because you are guilty of procrastinating? Procrastinators in the room. Yay! Glad to see I'm not the only one. Welcome, procrastinators. We'll have a support group. We'll have a support group meeting later on in the hallway. All right. I am here to talk to you about case law. Let me go ahead and remind you all the rules. Many of y'all have seen me do this a lot of times, but this is stuff that we collect. We've got a cutoff date. Cutoff date tends to be, what is it, October the 1st? So we basically, I'm already collecting cases for the new year that I'll be presenting, starting in Tyler. But this is stuff that we have collected from the last academic year. So if there's some newer case, you go, why is it not there? It was probably because of the date that it was handed down. I like to call this just enough information to keep you dangerous. There is no substitute for reading these cases in their entirety. I will be using the gratuitous PowerPoint presentation, so you can follow along. The paper, basically the PowerPoint just gives page numbers to show you where we are in the paper. I've already talked to y'all about the fact that, so my wife and I, we have had our second kid, and one of the things that I have figured out that is, one, I'm already starting to get this hint that girls are different, just a little bit. I'm starting to pick up on that. The second thing that I have experienced, and I just got to tell y'all, my wife and I did a home edition this last summer, and we lived in the house while we were doing the home edition. Have any of y'all ever done a home edition? Did you stay in the house? Okay. Was that not insane to try to stay in the house while they're doing this? Nothing quite like trying to stay in a house that's under construction in the middle of summer with an incredibly pregnant woman. Okay. All this pressure, all this tension, then we have this baby, the dust is cleared out, and now it's the strangest thing in the world. It's like I'm living in my house, but all of a sudden the pictures are no longer hanging on the walls. It's almost like playing Monopoly and having to go to jail or something. It's like you feel like you've lost progress. Maybe it's more like Chutes and Ladders, I guess it would be a more adapt game analogy. Because all of a sudden I'm living in my house, and it kind of still feels like the same house. But the house doesn't look the same. Everything's back in boxes, and there's this new kid that I've never met before. And it's almost like you're waking up, and you're like, wait a minute. It's like a blended life. So I am still trying to get a handle on this. And without further ado, let's go ahead and get a handle on some of these cases. We're going to start off talking about the First Amendment. I'm going to talk to you about Kleinman versus the city of San Marcos. Now, this is a case that got a lot of attention in municipal law circles. Got a good deal of attention by the national press. How many of you have heard of the infamous Art Car? You've heard of the Art Car? If you're from Manor, I bet you have, especially in Central Texas. This got a lot of attention. We have a business in Central Texas that's called Planet K. They say that they sell adult novelties. Where I come from, we call it a head shop, and they sell drug paraphernalia. I'm just saying, okay? And they pride themselves on taking these cars and turn them into planters. And so what you're seeing is a planter that was the subject of legal controversy because they were actually filed on for having a junked automobile. Their defense was, it's not an automobile. We have converted its purpose. It's not a car. It's a planter. And it's painted by artists, and it's a visual piece of art. This is one photograph of it. They painted at different points in time. This shows you them decommissioning and getting it ready. And then this is ultimately what it ended up looking like. Okay? So their argument is, that's not a junk car. That is a piece of art. And the city prosecuted them, filed charges in municipal court. They raised their First Amendment defense. It was rejected by the municipal judge. They then turned around and filed a lawsuit in state district court to enjoin the municipality from being able to enforce an illegal ordinance because it violated the First Amendment. The city then petitioned to have the case removed from district court and refiled in the United States District Court, which it was. The city got a favorable ruling in district court. I think the case was actually, you know, thrown out on summary judgment. And then they appealed it to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, this is an interesting case on a lot of different fronts. It's not often you get to see a city ordinance end up in the Fifth Circuit. It's not that often that you get to read a case involving a city ordinance in which the Visual Artists' Rights Act becomes an important legal concept. And, you know, depending on how this way, I was playing with this case in my mind, thinking about, hey, if they rule this one way, what would this mean to code enforcement in Texas towns? Can you imagine what it would be like if someone had, you know, tall weeds in front of their house and city files on them, and their defense is, this is not tall weeds, this is my representation of my inner soul. This is a manifestation of who I am as an individual, and that's the reason why I don't have to mow my yard. Or even better, that's no crack house. Okay, that's a piece of art. Okay, you can imagine possibly how this case could have gone, depending on the way the Fifth Circuit ruled. Now, the Fifth Circuit, just to, you know, I think the best way to summarize what they said is you can put paint on a junk car, it's still a junk car. And granted, this car is not operable, but y'all might remember that's one way you can have a junk vehicle is for it to be inoperable. And the mere fact that you have stripped it of many of its parts does not change the fact that this was an automobile, and it is still an automobile for the purpose of junk vehicle law. I think it's funny that we're talking about junk vehicle case law now. I never thought we would have a junk vehicle case law, but we do. And of course, you know, I could see some people arguing, yeah, but look, we're in the age of repurposing. You know, you see people are taking old airports and turning them into factories. You see people trying to recycle, reuse, re-engineer. We don't want to throw anything away. So there's also a good constituency out there that hate this case because they're saying, why the hell should this not be? You know, why in the hell is it not converted to a new purpose? Well, the answer is because it still has manifestations of an automobile. Take a look. You still have part of the front-end assembly still in place. At the end of the day, the easiest way to remember this case is the lipstick on a pig, okay? Still a pig. Not going to talk long about McDonald versus Douglas, but I do want y'all to know about this because for years, many of us who are gun enthusiasts have been wrong about our right to possess and bear arms. You have never had a right to possess and bear arms that's guaranteed to you at the state level. Your right to possess and bear arms given to you by the Second Amendment is a federal right that protects you from the federal government. And growing up as a kid who was a member of the NRA in Vernon, Texas, I just always thought that that was also a right that the states gave us. Now, of course, Texas has a Bill of Rights. So maybe it did under a state constitution. Maybe you do have that right. But to think that the federal constitution via the 14th Amendment, you know, I'm talking about selective incorporation, 14th Amendment, that's actually been incorrect until now. Okay, McDonald versus the city of Chicago is the case that now will be cited by the NRA correctly and properly for the proposition that even if your state does not guarantee you the right to possess and bear arms, that you have a right to possess and bear arms that is given to you by the Second Amendment and made applicable to all of the states through the 14th Amendment. Now, y'all might remember that we have a long history in this country, beginning especially in the 1960s, where we saw 4th Amendment, 5th Amendment, 6th Amendment. All of those things have been made applicable to the states via the 14th Amendment. Add to that list the Second Amendment. Only thing I want to say about this is, you know, it's hard for us as Texans to even get our minds around a city trying to regulate guns in this manner. Because, let me say, you would have like zero chance in hell of getting elected to a city council advocating. I don't care where you are. I don't care if you're in Austin or if you're in Tulia. You're not going to get elected to city council advocating this type of city ordinance. Let me explain to you the regulation because by Texan standards, it's pretty outrageous. You had to have your firearms registered at all times. You could not register handguns. So handguns were de facto made illegal, okay, because it wasn't registered, so it's an illegal firearm. They never said you couldn't have guns. They just said if you have because they have to be registered. Oh, and by the way, you can't register your handguns, okay? That's how they made handguns illegal. The second thing they did is they said that your guns, if they lapse, are illegal and can never be registered again. So let's go ahead and just, you know, think by analogy. How many of you have more than one car? Raise your hand, okay? Okay. By the way, study shows your grandchildren will not have more than one car. That shouldn't shock you, by the way, with the way that fuel's changing. Yeah, the days of the family having two or three cars, it's about to come to an end. All right. How many of you, now watch this, raise your hands again. How many of you have more than one car? Okay. How many of you will admit that at least on one instance you have forgotten to register your vehicle and you've driven that car and you go, oh, snap, I'm driving a car. Okay, that happens to me all the time, especially on my pickup truck because I don't drive it that often. All right. Now, okay, now watch this. How many of you have more than one firearm? God bless Texas. All right, we've got our guns. Now, imagine what it would be like if you forgot to register your rifle or your grandpa's L.C. Smith 12-gauge shotgun. Okay? Okay. That's what I'm talking about. Under this ordinance, that gun is now forever an illegal gun. You can never make your grandfather's shotgun a legal weapon again because once it lapses, it's illegal forever. Okay. That is what the Supreme Court shot down. That is what they said violated the Second Amendment. Okay, now, what did they not say? This is important, too. Do states have the right, in local governments, do they have the right to regulate where you take your gun? Oh, yes, they do. You know, in fact, I don't care how much of a gun fan you are, is there anyone in here who thinks that the public should have the right to bring firearms into your courtroom? Probably not the right audience to talk to about that, okay? But I know people who think they should. I have friends who are gun advocates who think that if they have a CHL, they have as much of a legal right to carry a gun into your courtroom as a peace officer or any. Now, and I have to say, yeah, that's where we're going to have a difference of opinions, okay? And that's something else you need to know about this case. This case also stands for the proposition that that states and cities have the right to regulate so they do take guns subject to reasonable means. So can the state of Texas say no guns on university public school grounds? Absolutely they can. Did we have an effort this session to take that out of the law so that you could take your CHL onto a public university? Yeah, we did, and it did not pass. Okay, so keep this in mind. Yes, extreme ordinances don't fly, especially here in Texas. I know you think this ordinance is pretty laughable. Also keep in mind, this is a case you would want to cite for the right court to prohibit people bringing weapons to your court facility, into your courtroom. All right. City of Ontario versus Kwan. How many of you have government-issued cell phones? Anyone got a government-issued cell phone in this room? All you cities a bunch of cheapskates? Oh, they are? They are. No, I'm just joking. Okay. How about this? How many of you own an alphanumeric pager? Anyone still have an alphanumeric pager? Going once, going twice. No one has alpha. Okay, anyone ever own an alphanumeric pager at any point in time? All right, can you believe that it's 2011, folks, and I'm about to talk to you about a Supreme Court case involving an alphanumeric pager. You want to talk about lag, continuing theme from the last hour, right? Okay, this is an important case, but not for the reason why you think it might be. Let me tell you the story of Jeffrey Kwan. Jeffrey Kwan is a member of a SWAT team in Ontario, California. How many of y'all know where Ontario, California is? You ever been there? Okay, be honest. You only know where Ontario, California is because Southwest Airlines flies there. That's me. It's the only reason I know Ontario, California exists. All right, now, maybe I should learn geography through Southwest Airlines. I would only have to learn 70 cities and I would be done. Okay, so here's the deal. Jeffrey's on the SWAT team. And the city has a policy, which, by the way, I think that this case stands for the proposition that these are bad policies, that in tough financial times, the government can issue you an alphanumeric pager or a cell phone, and then you could make a, quote, cash contribution for your own personal use of the phone. Now, do you see how this is already a bad idea? Okay, so the government's going to buy something, but you get to use it for your own personal use, but you've got to make a cash contribution. Okay, that's what happened. And so, of course, Jeffrey thinks he's getting something for his money, right? I mean, you would think he could use it for his own personal uses. And he did. He liked to send sexually explicit messages to his wife, okay? And he also liked to send incredibly sexually explicit messages to his girlfriend, who was not his wife, but was the police dispatcher. Dun, dun, dun. All right, it's already getting good, right? We've got sex. We've got the little love triangle cooking. All right, it gets even better. Jeffrey is sending so many sexually explicit messages along with his colleagues. I don't know if they're sending explicit messages, that they've gone over their allotted number of text messages they're allowed to send every month. How many of you have said, minus the sex, I've had problems like this with either my spouse or my daughter or kid about sending too many text messages and going over their allotments? That's a new parental problem, right? How many of y'all have had to discipline a spouse or a child for not the number of texting? You know, texting's getting out of control. All right. Now, get this. The city manager goes, we disagree. We don't think we're going over. The telecommunication provider goes, yes, you are. City goes, okay, give us the messages. Uh-oh, here we go. We're off to the races. They then provide a transcript of Jeffrey Kwan's libido sending out all these hot, risque messages to his wife and to his girlfriend who don't know that he's simultaneously sending sex messages to both of them. Mind you, he is a trailblazer. He is years ahead of Anthony Weiner, okay? And so what happens next is he then is like, you've embarrassed me by disclosing my messages. He sues the communication provider, and then he sues his employer for violating his Fourth Amendment rights. Because just as your children do not leave their Fourth Amendment protections at the door when they go to school, you and other governmental appointees or employees do not leave their Fourth Amendment rights at the door when they go to work. Now, we had a case called Ortega versus O'Connor. Actually, O'Connor versus Ortega. It's an old case from the 1980s. And the question was, we know that governmental employees have Fourth Amendment rights, but they place, and we have to use a slightly different standard. We never quite got a clear standard from the Supreme Court about how standards are we supposed to use when we're looking at these Fourth Amendment workplace cases, okay? So everyone thought that this is the case in which we were going to get a clear answer. And at the end of the day, it didn't matter because the Supreme Court did not give us a new clear standard. We thought they would. They did not. Rather, they said it doesn't matter which standard you use. Jeffrey Kwan loses. Now, I need to back up a little bit on the procedure on this. One, Jeffrey sued. He lost in district court. He appealed and won in U.S. District Court, but it's the Ninth Circuit. Okay, you've always got to be suspect of the federal Ninth Circuit. They're the ones who said, like, the Pledge of Allegiance is unconstitutional and all this stuff. Okay, so, but here is the real Achilles heel here. The Achilles heel, so let me ask you this. How many of you have jobs that y'all have HR policies, like human resource, like, a, you know, an employee manual, things of that? And how many of those manuals talk about email and stuff of that nature? Like government, you know, like we have one at TMCEC about your TMCEC issued email account. But here's the thing. They did too in Ontario, but they didn't have one that covered text messaging. And because of that, that's the reason why the Ninth Circuit said that his rights were violated, because the policy only covered one type of technology, not all types of technology. And they said, guess what? Text messaging is not email, and it's not a computer, and it's different. Okay, so now we're in front of the Supreme Court, and now you're going to see why you need to know about this case. It's not because of the fact that this is a seminal, important case in the world of criminal law, or even for the Fourth Amendment. What's more notable than the holding of this case is the way that the media reacted to it and what it means to you as judges. Because this case was heavily scrutinized by the drive-by media, not for the holding, but rather because of the way that the members of the court handled themselves during oral arguments. Now, I'm going to go ahead and pull my copy of this out here, but let me go ahead and give you some examples. At one point, there seemed to be confusion, and it almost appeared that members of the court did not know the difference between a text message and email. And the media really had a lot of fun with this. At one point, Scalia asks a question in which he says, you know, so the, you know, what's the difference between an email and a text message? My favorite one is Kennedy says, so you're telling us, and he's, what would happen if one person's trying to text message someone while someone else is text messaging them while someone else is trying to text message them, would they get a message that says, your call is very important to us, we will get back to you as soon as possible? And things like this led members of the media to believe what we don't think, that the members of the Supreme Court have a very good grasp on this. Let me give you another one. Another one is that Chief Justice Roberts ended up saying, you know, what is the difference between the pager and the email? Kennedy, says, does it say your call is important to us and we will get back to you? And then Scalia appeared unfamiliar with the role of a service provider in terms of text messaging when he said, you mean the text doesn't go right to me? Okay, hopefully y'all all know that when y'all send a text message, it doesn't go straight to you. It's being relayed through a series of towers before it comes to you. Well, the media just became obsessed with, are the members of the court competent in technology? Which begs the question, are you, judges, competent in technology? Because what I think this case ultimately stands for is, you're living in the 21st century. You know, there are so many things that have come to pass technologically that I have a hard time believing are real. I saw during this session a robot on the floor of the Texas Senate. For real. Little boy who can't go to school because of a compromised immune system, he goes to school every day via a robot. He uses an avatar to interact with his friends while he's back at home. It's real. Okay? I saw a demonstration last week on CNN of the Navy firing a laser beam at a boat and blowing it up with a laser. Okay? What's next? Flying cars? Yes, flying car. You can buy one. $375,000, it can go from being a car to taking off like a jump jet and flying. Glenn Phillips, I know you're going to want to buy one of those. You need to control yourself. Okay? These are things that are happening now. And because these technologies are readily available, people's expectations of judges have always been different. But here's the thing I want you to know. You know, look, just as I'm sure there was at some point in time which people were clinging saying, I don't get these telephones, I'm a telegraph guy and I always will be, many of you are going to need to understand that, look, if you're not on the internet, if you don't know the difference between Twitter and Facebook, and if you don't understand the difference between a fax and an email, it's time. The media response to this is a manifestation that people just think that you're all-knowing, the judges understand stuff. And the other thing is, it's going to be important in the future that you do understand. Have any of y'all had cases in your court involving digital photographs? Have y'all had anyone who's trying to brought, you know, how do you lay the predicate for a digital picture? Okay, how many of you are seeing more squad car footage? Dashboard cameras taking. Okay, what's the predicate for that? Okay, these are all things that involve technology and you as judges, and you're not going to be able to say, "Hey, these are just Class C misdemeanors. We don't have to know it." Okay, because the reality is, I got to be honest with you. A lot of the evolution in technology that I'm seeing is directly going to impact how police conduct law enforcement things. Look, if y'all stay on the bench another 10 to 15 years, you're going to see people asking for search warrants to get data off of people's cars to see how fast they were driving at certain points in time. That's going to happen. Well, and it's already happening in crash cases and, you know, personal injury lawsuits. So really at the end of the day, on this, the reason why I'm talking to you about Jeffrey Kwan, not just the fact because it's a little salacious, is because the Kwan case, the media's response was pretty clear. The public expects judges to be with it when it comes to technology. TMC East is trying to lead the way. Look, we're trying to try new things. I'm not sure how many of you. How many of you are on Facebook? Are y'all on Facebook? I'm sure we got a good. Okay, here's the deal. TMC EC, we've been on Facebook since January 6th. We want to encourage you to like us, to follow us. It's fun. Not only that, it's a way you'll be able to get information from us in ways that you can't now. Are any of you already following us on Facebook? Have anyone in here? Okay, well, good. Then we got two. Then if you've been looking at what we're doing on Facebook, you see that we're posting news stories every single day, every week, to keep you in the fold of what's happening to things that relate to municipal courts. It's one more way that we can communicate with y'all. And by the way, in the age of budget cuts, by the way, you can say sayonara to your recorder. You will not be getting any more paper copies of the recorder unless you subscribe to one. This is going to be the way that you're going to be getting your information from us. And we're taking other steps. The Online Learning Center, you're going to see more webinars. Hopefully you'll see, as time goes on, more opportunities to get different types of credit or different types of learning experiences without even leaving your office. And I know for some folks, like folks out in Anthony, Texas, I bet you that would be welcomed. Okay, so that's where we're going with this. Let's talk more mainstream Fourth Amendment stuff. Let's talk a little bit about Jordan. It's a blood case. Blood warrants are a big deal, not just in Texas, but everywhere right now. Last year, I talked to you about a Fourth Amendment case that came out of Houston, and that case was called Dugas. And the question in Dugas was, and I'm curious, how many of you have ever signed a blood draw warrant? Have y'all signed one? Okay. The question in Dugas was, does the magistrate who is reviewing an affidavit for a blood draw warrant, do we give that magistrate the same amount of deference that we do on a regular search warrant, or is it going to be different? Okay. And what they said in Dugas is, no, just like a regular search warrant. You have to give the magistrate a little bit of slack, okay? You have to let them look at the document in light of the four corners of information. You have to allow them to make reasonable inferences when they're making that determination of probable cause. Well, Jordan asked the exact same question to a different intermediate court of appeals, and the answer was absolutely opposite from what we were told in Dugas. While Dugas says it's just like a regular search warrant, you have to allow the magistrate to make reasonable inferences based off the information in the four corners. Nope, that's not what the third court says. The third court of appeals says, and by the way, so for folks like out in San Angelo, this case would be binding all over that part of the state. They're saying, because let me tell you the specific issue, does the peace officer have to state what time and on what day they believed the person was driving while intoxicated? Dugas said no, not necessary, because of the fact that you could tell from the bookend sheet the time that he was arrested and the time that the information was brought to the magistrate, he could reasonably infer that. No, Jordan says absolutely not. That's not something you can infer. It's something that needs to be stated. Now, mind you, it does not have to be necessarily right, okay? A peace officer can say, I think this is what time he was driving, and that probably would be legally sufficient, because proving it up is another entirely different matter. That's something we do at trial. But we do see now a variation or a separation between two different courts of appeals, and we'll have to watch this issue closely. The Flores case has to do with dumpster diving. How many of you have ever issued a search warrant based off of information that was pulled out of a garbage can? Anybody ever done that before? It's actually very, very common, especially in drug cases, for police officers to go recon people's garbage cans and to see what information they can find and what stuff they can come across. In this case, this is what we have. We have a confidential informant combined with two dumpster dives in which law enforcement have found traces of drugs. And based off of that, they go to the magistrate and ask for the search warrant. Magistrate signs it. The question that the Court of Criminal Appeals ends up having to determine is, should the magistrate have ever signed that search warrant? Okay. In previous cases, it looked like you had to have more than just a confidential informant and two dumpster dives at the same physical address. In this case, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that alone is enough for the magistrate to issue the search warrant. Now, two members of the court dissented. Judge Myers dissented. In his dissent, he says the missing link here is just because there's a confidential informant saying there's people in that house who do drugs, and just because you find drug residue in the garbage, you still have no link between, was the drug residue taken from that house and placed on that curb? Now, think about this for a second. If it's just that easy to get a search warrant, then I don't know about you, but if I'm going to be using drugs from now on, I'm going to make sure I put my drugs and my drug residue in your garbage can and not in my own. Okay, and that was kind of the point of the dissent. Nevertheless, the majority of the court said that this was legally acceptable. All right. Okay, the next one, I will warn you, is a little bit PG-13. I'm not here to shock you, but I'm going to tell you this is the law. I'm here just to report the facts. Texas has a weird obscenity statute. I'm not sure if you know about this, but Texas has a very strange obscenity statute. And this case highlights the strange obscenity statute. Here's your fact pattern. You've got some Uncle Rico guy driving around with a bunch of underage girls, and he's giving them alcohol. Commits a traffic offense. He gets caught. They figure out that he's been giving them booze. He's going to get arrested for that. they go and they search the car. They search the car, they find some pornos, they find a tripod, a camcorder. It's not looking very wholesome, stuff that we're pulling out of the back of that trunk. They want to go get a search warrant to search the guy's house based off the fact that they probably think that this guy is engaged in either sex trafficking, or he might be involved in some type of kiddie porn ring, or he's definitely involved in some illegal sex conduct related to kids. One of the girls testifies later that he had videotaped her having sex with her boyfriend. Now, this is where it gets interesting. They don't have enough probable cause to get a search warrant for kiddie porn because there's no kiddie porn in the trunk. Okay? This is where the Texas obscenity statute comes into play. Okay. In Texas, if you have more than 5 sex toys, there is a statutory presumption that you intend to distribute these things, and that makes it obscene. Time out on the field. Clean your ears out. You heard me right. If you have 5 sex toys, you're wholesome, and there's nothing wrong here. But you got 6, intention to distribute, that's illegal in Texas. Go back again. 5, morning in America, 6, deviant sexual conduct. All right, now, they use the content of the trunk to get a search warrant to see if the guy has any more, because there are some sex toys in the back, in the trunk of the vehicle. They want to go search the house to see if he has more than 5. They get inside the house, they find all other types of incriminating evidence, and he is a child molester, and he is involved in all this bad stuff. And that's how we end up in front of the Intermediate Court of Appeals. In the Intermediate Court of Appeals, they end up having this question about, he challenges the magistrate's determination to issue the search warrant. And it happens, and for those of you all, do I have anyone who's from Ellis County or from southern part of Dallas County? Got any Dallas folks around here? Dallas County. Y'all might remember, this has been litigated a lot in that part of Texas. There is a woman, I think she's in Ennis, who even has like Tupperware parties where she invites people over and they can buy sex toys from her, okay? And she's been prosecuted at one point by the DA's office, and there was a federal civil rights lawsuit filed in regard to this. And the day before this search warrant was issued, a United States District Court judge found the Texas statute saying 5 is okay, but 6 is illegal to be unconstitutional. Okay? So they argue on appeal that this search warrant should be no good because this U.S. District Court judge said that the Texas, 5 is wholesome and 6 is deviant provision was illegal. The Intermediate Court of Appeals properly points out that guess what? Because of the 10th Amendment and our dual court structure, decisions of U.S. District Court judges are absolutely not binding on any Texas trial court, nor are they binding on any intermediate appellate court. And if you want that to be a compelling argument, you better take it to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals and get them to say that they agree that that violates, that's an unconstitutional statute. They did file their PDR with the Court of Criminal Appeals. They didn't get a single vote. Still illegal to have. It's still legal to have 5 sex toys and illegal to have 6 sex toys in the great state of Texas. Go figure. All right. That's a weird one, isn't it? It's very, most obscenity statutes in other states have nothing about these objects in them. It makes Texas a very unique state. Okay. Last year I talked to you about a case called Gant. Gant is a very important case because Gant is the first time in about 15 years that the Supreme Court of the United States has pulled back on the reins of law enforcement, and they say, just because you arrest someone doesn't mean you get to search their car. Let's go back on this. You get to search a car if you think that they can reach for a gun. You get to search their car if they're close enough that they can reach and destroy evidence. But you don't get to search their car just because you arrested them. That's essentially what Gant said. All right? We've got a long history in this nation of cops arresting someone at the front of the grocery store and their Winnebago's 200 yards out in the parking lot, and the cops all of a sudden feel like they get to search the car just because they arrest them, even though there's a wife who can drive the car. Okay? Don't confuse this with inventories, okay? An inventory is an exception to the Fourth Amendment. I am not talking about inventories. As y'all know, if when someone gets arrested in their car, the police will make an inventory of the content of that automobile. You know, we got Michael Bolton CD. Don't know why anybody would want a Michael Bolton CD. You got chapstick, you know. And if they're going through that, they also say, whoops, and we also found your brass knuckles, then that can be a separate violation. There's no Fourth Amendment issue there because inventories are separate from Fourth Amendment. Okay, now, here's your fact pattern. It's so funny because we just drove over Dallas yesterday and I was able to see from an aerial view where this whole little thing went down. Big shocker, there's criminal activity afoot on Harry Hines Boulevard in Dallas, Texas. For any of you who have ever lived in Dallas, I haven't told you anything you don't already know. High crime activity area, police officer actually knows the individuals who are involved. And by the way, that's never good too. You know, there are more police officers employed in Dallas, Texas than some of your cities have population. And for any one police officer to say, oh, you again, is never good. Okay. Cop comes up on this, folks. Girlfriend sees him, looks back, tells her boyfriend, get the stepping. Cops are here. This is no good. They start walking. Man's got something in his hand. Opens the door to the car, throws it in the car. They keep walking. Cop catches up with them. Cop determines that they are intoxicated. Now he decides to arrest them. Now he decides he wants to go inside that car to find what boyfriend threw back inside of the passenger compartment. All right, now, let's see a show of hands. How many folks do I have in here who are criminal defense lawyers? Where are my criminal defense lawyers? Okay, I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, criminal defense lawyers. Have you ever in the history of your practice heard of a PI case where preserving the chain of evidence is an important issue in the police investigation of a PI? Anyone, going once, okay? Judges, have any of you, how many of you judges have actually had a trial on a PI case? How many of you have tried PI cases, okay? Have you ever seen at trial either the state or the defense raise an issue about preserving the evidence of intoxication? Anyone, ever? I now have for you a published case on the very point. Now, for criminal defense lawyers, file this thing away. You can have some fun with this, okay? I'm not sure if any other court will ever dance with you on this, but in this case, this is what they said. They said that under Gant, it was okay to go into the automobile to retrieve the liquid because the liquid was believed to be evidence of why the man was publicly intoxicated. Now, I think this is classic because the standard M1A1 government-issued unpublished decision on public intoxication is a dude who's drunk, who's standing next to a roadway. How many of y'all have ever heard of that case or seen that case in your courtroom? That is the vast majority of cases involving public intoxication. Peace officer comes across a subject standing close to the road. He's staggering. He might fall off into Harry Hines Boulevard. That is your generic PI case, okay? This is not your standard PI case. Nevertheless, they now have to apply the case law given to us last year by the Supreme Court in Gant, and they do it. Here's what they say. Was he close to the evidence? Yes. Is the evidence related to the suspected offense? Yes. Could that evidence be used as an element of proving that he committed the criminal offense? Yes. So that's the reason why this was a valid search of the person's automobile. But with that said, I'm still going to say this is an interesting case because never have I heard of police officers being, you know, do you think they really cared about the PI? Of course not. Do they think the guy's got drugs in his car? Of course they think that. They're looking for an opportunity to get in the car, and they did it legally. Okay, let's stay in Dallas, Texas for a second. Mark's got a great class on the agenda this year about bicycles, okay? And let me tell you, with gas prices back up, hovering around, you know, what did I see here yesterday, like $3.79, $3.89 a gallon? Woo, it's actually more expensive to get gas than in Austin. That kind of surprised me a little bit. And at the same time, you're going to see more people, you know, riding bicycles, which is good for your health, by the way. I know y'all got, I understand, like I'm from Vernon, Texas. I can tell by looking at your name tags that 3/4 of you are from communities. When I say bicycle, you go, phew. You think, toy, not a real legitimate way of getting around. And I say to you, 21st century, everyone's got surcharges. They can't get driver's license and insurance. And more people, you know, you got people driving on I-35 on their lawnmowers. You've got people who are, they got to get to stepping because it's the only way they can legally exist. And then you've got Mr. Portillo, the neighborhood drug courier who delivers dope by means of bicycle, okay? And Mr. Portillo gets taken down by the man, gets arrested by Dallas PD for not wearing his bicycle helmet, or his bicycle helmet, which, by the way, under the City of Dallas Code of Ordinances is a Class C misdemeanor, okay? And could the cop have written him a ticket? Yes. Did the cop have to write him a ticket? No, because remember, only open container and speeding do they have to give you the chance to sign that ticket. Everything else, if they got PC, they can arrest you just like they would anything else. That's exactly what they did. They arrest Mr. Portillo, they find the drugs. So now his criminal defense lawyer is trying to defend this guy, and the only opportunity he really has is to try to shoot down, knock the legs out of the Dallas bicycle helmet ordinance. He does not succeed. But nevertheless, this case leaves me with a smile on my face. Can you imagine the bookend down there at Loose Sterrett? This guy gets arrested. They're taking him in there. Mug shots. He's processed. He goes into the tank. He's in there. Guys talking about how they got there. I shot this man. I stole this. I sold drugs. I'm a rapist. How about you? Bicycle helmet ordinance violation. That had to have been the high point of the entire moment in the jail right there on that day. All right. Now. And completely legal, I might add. Completely legal that he was arrested on that bicycle helmet ordinance. All right. Clark is a case out of Abilene. Okay. So now we're kind of moving out towards west of Dallas. Here's the deal. This guy, it's early in the morning. He's spinning and squealing his tires. I'm really almost getting tired of talking about cases where cops do not know the elements of racing on the highway. They don't know the elements. They still don't know the elements. Y'all might remember there's one type of racing on the highway that's called amputation of acceleration. Y'all might remember when those used to get filed in municipal courts. Should any of you be seeing that offense filed in your court anymore? No, because it's been a Class B misdemeanor for 6 years now, or like 4 years now. Maybe 6 years, actually. Well, now that's where I'm going with this. Thank you, Judge. That's exactly where I'm going with this. Okay, now this is what happens. The cop stops him for racing on the highway, exhibition of acceleration. He's drunk. He arrests him. Now, motion to suppress. The defense lawyer says, according to Texas case law, you cannot exhibit acceleration unless you are engaged in a competition with one or more automobiles. And he's absolutely right, Judge. That is the law. In Texas, that is the law. And that's one of the things I want y'all to be clear on. I had a case last year out of Austin that said the exact same thing. You cannot engage in exhibition of acceleration unless you're doing speed time trials or unless you're doing American Graffiti side-by-side car races. All right, there's some colorful references. Probably only half of you got the American Graffiti reference, but some of you did, and that's good enough. Okay, now, here's the deal. The city of Amarillo, just as the judge has suggested, has an ordinance on the book. And the book and the ordinance makes it a Class C misdemeanor to create a nuisance using your automobile. They don't care how you do it. If it's a nuisance, it's a Class C misdemeanor. The problem is the cop did not know that that city ordinance existed. The question before the appellate court is, does it matter that the cop had no clue what the city ordinance actually prohibited? And the answer is, it does not matter that the cop did not know. The question is, was there a legal basis for that guy to have been arrested? And the answer is, yes. So do we care about the subjective knowledge of any one cop? No. We care about what is the law, okay? And the law in Abilene, Texas is that they have an ordinance that prohibits using your vehicle to create a nuisance. Thus, this guy's stop was illegal, and subsequent discovery that he was DWI was also illegal, and that's where we stand on that. Okay. Now, that brings me up here to Gonzalez Galando. It's always great to talk about cases. Yeah. You got a question, Tim? No, listen. He arrested him based off of exhibition of acceleration. But even in his police report, he admits that there was no one else out there with him. This guy was just peeling out. He peeled out of a parking lot at 2 in the morning in Abilene, Texas. The cop arrests him for exhibition of acceleration. The problem is, for exhibition of acceleration to occur, it has to occur in the context of a competition between two automobiles, all right? And so the cops screwed up, okay? The question before the appellate court is, though, but what about, you know, but there is an ordinance in Abilene that says you can't use your car to create a nuisance. The state, the county court of law said it doesn't matter that the cop was wrong with the law. It matters what the law is, not what the cop thought it was, all right? Intermediate Court of Appeals agreed with that. They agreed with that. All right. Now, Gonzalez, and the law that the cop didn't know about was the ordinance. That's what the cop, so there was a law that was applicable. Yeah, Bruce. The 10 million watt stereos, I'm sure it does. You know, that'd be a kind of a fact question, but does it apply to those stereos? It possibly could. All right, let me talk to you about my favorite case of the year. This Gonzalez, Galando case that's stated on page 8 and 9. Now, here's the deal. We're going to play a little game here. I don't want you to look at this, though. I want you all to just look up here because we're going to play a little game. You see, this is great. This is the interactive part. You're going to love this. You're going to use your left hand. Raise your left hand when you think. I'm going to give you the fact pattern. Now, don't cheat, Tim. I see you looking down now. Everyone has to look up. Okay, you're going to raise your left hand. I'm going to read you the police report. Raise your left hand if you think that the cop has reasonable suspicion to stop the vehicle for a moment. Okay, then you're going to go ahead and raise your right hand. Make sure you're clear. Right hand if you think that the police officer has probable cause to believe that a criminal offense has occurred. Are y'all clear on this? Left hand, reasonable suspicion. Right hand, probable cause. Okay, before we get started, would any of you like to raise either of your hands? Okay, here we go. All right, good. I'm glad to see you're still neutral and detached fact finders here. Okay, this is all taken verbatim from the police report as to why they stopped these guys. By the way, I think this happened somewhere not far from Muleshoe. It was either Muleshoe. It might not be far from Alpine, but it's out here in this part of the state, I'll tell you. This is a far west Texas case. Okay, here we go. Here's what comes from the police report. The vehicle in which the occupants rode was clean and light and lacked road grime. Would anyone like to raise their hands? By the way, all of these reasons are the reasons why the cops decided to stop the car. This is their explanation. No one's going for that yet. Okay, how about two? The young occupants did not fit the year and model of the vehicle, the latter being a 1999 Illumina. Really? The car? They didn't fit the car? That's the reason why you stopped them? No one yet? All right, I'm sure we'll get to the third one. How about this? The troopers thought that the vehicle's occupants should have been in a sportier car. I'm not making this up. All right? Four, both occupants simultaneously looked away from the officers as the vehicles met and passed. Okay. How about five? The occupants turned their hats around so they faced forward after passing the troopers. Wow. Okay. The car slowed and came to an almost complete stop at a blinking caution light adjacent to an intersection. Okay, well, I'm sure the last one, all the hands are going to go up, which is that the driver drove within the speed limit. Based off these reasons, the peace officer stopped this vehicle. Well, then what happens next? They ask if they can search the car. And when they search the car, they end up finding drugs. And now the case is filed in a state district court. The defense lawyer makes a motion to suppress. I have no clue how or why the district judge denied the motion to suppress. This is the whole reason for the stop. Okay? And the Intermediate Court of Appeals ends up saying, well, it gets even better. This is the only reason they have to stop the vehicle. The Intermediate Court of Appeals essentially just backhands. I mean, they just completely backhand law enforcement in this case. He even talks about the fact that some people like spaghetti, some people don't like spaghetti. Some people like spaghetti with meatballs, some people don't like spaghetti with meatballs, and no one cares what type of cars you like or what type of cars you think people should be driving. And, you know, and I'm wondering how this even get here. I can only imagine that either the district judge had a primary opponent or this case was decided 2 weeks before election day. I have no clue how a district judge concludes that this is a legal stop. And ultimately, it wasn't. I lay it out to you because it's outrageous. It's my really, really, really case. But on top of that, I want you to know about it because a bunch of traffic lawyers, well, not a bunch, one traffic lawyer who has access to the internet, began sending this case to every municipal judge who lived in the Houston area into the jail. That you may not use Texas Sure, the database. Y'all know about Texas Sure. You use it to do insurance verification. The cop cannot use it as the basis of stopping a car. Nowhere in this case is the word Texas Sure ever printed. There is reference to a database. They tried to use the database, and the results were inconclusive. Be careful. This case, I think, is also the case most likely to be misrepresented to you by a defense lawyer in a municipal court proceeding about the basis for a stop. Look, it is true. There was no basis for the stop, but I just told you why there was no basis for the stop. It's got nothing to do with Texas Sure. I do believe, though, we're going to have a Texas Sure case to talk about in this next year's case law update. Okay. Berkus versus Tompkins, so you say you want to remain silent. Y'all might remember this case. This was kind of Justice Sotomayor's debut party as a outspoken dissenter. This is the case that now says that if you're going to invoke your right to remain silent, you have to say you want to invoke your right to remain silent. I want to make sure you don't get confused by this. If you want to remain silent, you cannot remain silent. Rather, if you want to remain silent, you must not remain silent. Rather, you must make noise and say, you see where I'm going with this. This is why some people don't like this opinion. Because now the defendant used to be able to just say nothing, and by saying nothing, they were invoking their right to silence. Now they have to affirmatively manifest their intent to remain silent. Now, do I have any former peace officers in the room? I think I do. Okay. If you're former law enforcement, you understand why this is a good decision. Okay? Because you don't want cops wondering if they've invoked their right or not. And you don't want to find out, you know, when you're after the case has been tried and now it's up on appeal, that guy or gal had invoked their right. Nevertheless, this case is problematic. And there are a lot of folks who don't like this case. You just need to know, you know, under this case, when have they invoked the right to remain silent? When they have affirmatively said so. Okay? Not just by being quiet. Okay. Padilla. Show of hands again, criminal defense lawyers. I think I got about six of you in here. Raise your hand one more time so I can see where you are. All right. Padilla, there are very few things I know for a fact, but let me tell you what I know. What I know right now is that Justin Bieber is popular with girls, okay? And I also know that this is the most frequently mentioned case from the last term of the Supreme Court before the criminal defense bar. Now, does it directly impact municipal court proceedings? No, but you still need to know what happened. You still need to know what's going on. Criminal defense lawyer, however, this is a game changer. This might absolutely change the way you do business because you're going to have to in a lot of this case. Mr. Padilla has been in the United States of America legally for over 25 years. He has children, he has jobs, he's got grandchildren, and Mr. Padilla gets caught with drugs. He's prosecuted in a federal court. He has a lawyer. He asks his lawyer, if I take a plea deal, is it going to affect my ability to stay in the country? The guy says, no, you've been here so long, you don't need to worry about it. That was the wrong thing to say. Mr. Padilla is convicted, and the federal government begins deportation proceedings to expel him from the United States of America. In this case, the Supreme Court finds that the conduct of the lawyer fell so far below the minimal standards that we would expect for assistance of counsel that the conviction's invalid because the lawyer was ineffective. All right, that's the reason why, as criminal defense lawyers, this is a game changer. Depending on who you talk to now, you're going to have to all bone up on your immigration law, or you're going to have to become really good friends with someone who practices immigration law who's going to answer questions for you and your clients. Because prior to this case, if you got deported, that was just considered a collateral consequence of your conviction. It was not considered to be part of the punishment. Post-Padilla, deportation is a part of the criminal punishment. That's the game changer, okay? They have said that immigration law has become so complicated now that it's ridiculous for us to act like that getting kicked out of the country after you've been here legally for a quarter of your life is not punitive. It is punitive. Now, let's make sure, because some of you, I know you're probably zoning in and out, thinking about lunch, all this other stuff. You might be thinking, how does this relate to us? Okay. It does not relate to you as judges. You are not obligated to do any type of, you know, admonishments. It doesn't change that. It's got nothing to do with that. However, for lawyers who represent people, this case, you know, if you see someone in your municipal courtroom and they are representing that person, you know, I'll give you an example. There is actually Class C assault family violence involving contact is a basis for deportation if someone's convicted. I could easily see now some lawyer saying, hey, don't sweat it, bub. It's a fine only misdemeanor. Nothing's going to happen to you. Well, guess what? If federal government finds out about it, something could happen to you. And now that's how we could see how this Padilla case could be of import. Yeah. Yep. So it doesn't apply to that either. It does not apply to people who are proceeding. This only applies to the relationship between criminal defense lawyer and client. But it's significant. It's probably, like I said, it is the biggest case of the last term relating to criminal defense lawyers. And we don't see cases like this every session. Okay, two big cases from the Court of Criminal Appeals. I bet you you're familiar with both of these cases by now. Spence is a case that came out of Amarillo, and the question posed is, must you have your license plate attached to the front bumper of the car, or can you legally have it in the front windshield or the front part of your automobile? Okay. We had had a case called LaSoya that came out of the Austin Court of Appeals that had held that having a license plate on the front dashboard propped up was the front of the automobile. And the Amarillo court said that's not the front of the automobile. The front of the automobile means the front, the utmost front part of the automobile means it has to be attached to the bumper. Now, those of you who are saying, are you seriously telling me that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals granted PDR on this case? And the answer is, yes, I'm telling you they did. But here's what you need to know. Mr. Spence is a three-time loser, and he was sentenced to 38 years on a probation revocation stemming from the fact that he got busted, got caught with drugs because of, you guessed it, a license plate violation. But for his license plate violation, the cops would have never found his drugs and he would have never been sent to the penitentiary. That's the reason why the Court of Criminal Appeals is deciding this case. So we are, once again, kind of like, you know, the ancillary or the unintended beneficiaries of this opinion. But it definitely relates to things that we see. How many of y'all have seen these cases filed in your court? You haven't? Well, let me tell you where it's a big deal. You know, especially with, like, if you're people who are big into cars, trying to get an owner of a Corvette to put a license plate on the front bumper, for them, they think it's sacrilegious. They really do. They think you are defacing a beautiful automobile. It's the law in Texas. They even have automated kits now where you can push an electric button and it will fold up underneath and push it again and it'll fold up out on front, okay? Glenn wants one of those because he has a Corvette, so he wants that now, okay? He's also going to get a flying car before we leave the school. Yeah, okay, well, so here's the deal. It's a tiebreaker. Court of Criminal Appeals had to say who's right, Austin or Amarillo. And guess who was right? Amarillo. Front of the car means front most part of the car. It means the front bumper. Okay? Now, two members of the court, Judge Hervey and Judge Myers, dissented in this case. And I like their dissent because they said if the front of the car is the front bumper, then the rear of the car, because you also have to have one on the rear of the car, must mean, by your analysis, say it, the rear bumper. But where, again, is your license plate actually located? It's located on the hood flap is where it is. In fact, unless you have a pickup truck, you know, or an older car, none of your license plates are located on the rear bumper. All right. So that's Spence. The Mahaffey case is a crazy case. Mahaffey, this thing is never going to go away. It's the case is still pending. It's still going on, even though the Court of Criminal Appeals issued this opinion. Mr. Mahaffey is driving out of Tyler, Texas. And he's driving out of Tyler, and he gets stopped, and he gets arrested for DWI in Tyler, Texas. And the basis for the stop is that he failed to use his turn signal as the road he was on merged with another roadway. Let me make sure you're clear on this. The road that he was on ceased to exist. It merged with another roadway. He failed to use his turn signal as the road merged. Question is, do you have to use your turn signal when a road merges? Amarillo Court of Appeals said yes. Transportation code says anytime that you're turning, you must use your turn signal. This is where it gets fun, because now we have to have a debate about what it means to turn. Okay? Does that mean the car is turning? Does that mean the road's turning? Okay? The Court of Criminal Appeals says, Tyler, you're wrong. That is way, way overbroad. That's a ridiculous construction. If that's true, that would mean that as the curvature of a highway occurs, that operators of automobiles would have to ride their turn signals into a curve. And that's insane. Okay. Well, so, tell a little quick story. I took driver's ed, as most of you did, with a baseball coach as a driver's ed teacher. Mine, Jabe Brazel. Jabe Brazel, Vernon, Texas, like 1986, I had this driver's ed class. Jabe used to play baseball when he was a kid. Big old guy. He's like 6'4", 6'5", probably 325. Can you imagine a guy that big having to be in a Ford Escort with two high school age kids? He's over there with his driver's ed break. And I clearly remember the day that we did our driving that the girl who was up in the front, she was a triplet. I can't remember if it was Faith, Hope, or Charity Chisholm, but it was one of the three. And I'm in the back seat, and as it's time to drive, the girl pops the car into drive, grabs that steering wheel, pulls it down, steps on the gas, and does not have her hand anywhere near the steering wheel. Coach Brazel's slamming on that parking brake, you know, the driver's ed brake that they get, the safety brake. He goes, "What do you think you're doing?" And her response is, "I'm driving." He goes, "You're not driving. What do you think you're doing?" He goes, "Well, I'm turning the car. I'm using the turn signal." And he says, "Well, what do you think that's for?" And he's pointing to the steering wheel. She goes, "Well, I thought that's just where you put your hands." Okay. I was wanting to get out of the car at that moment. But it kind of goes back to this. You know, what turns the car? The turn signal? Do you have to use your turn signal when the road merges? The Court of Criminal Appeals says no. Judge Keller dissents, saying that the court's the one who's being hyper-technical. And at one point, Judge Price says, "Well, if that's true, then like if a cop came up behind you and they got a distress call and they turned on their lights, you'd have to use your turn signal to get out of their way. And if you didn't, you'd commit a criminal offense." Judge Keller literally says, I'm not making this up, "So what?" That's her response. She said that that person would have an automatic defense of necessity if they were to be cited for not using their turn signal. By the way, for those of you who are criminal law addicts like I am, it's not every day that Sharon Keller is giving tips to criminal defense lawyers on what defenses they can raise. All right, now, so at the end of the day, this case is reversed. Still going on. I will likely be talking about this case again to you next year, because you know what they did when it got remanded? Now they found that, okay, it doesn't matter. He's still guilty. Because once the road merged, he did not use his turn signal when he went into the next lane of traffic. He's filed another PDR with the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. The saga continues on. All right. Now, I got about 5 minutes left. Yeah, go ahead. Is the lane ending? Well, see, and those are going to be the questions. That's going to be, in this case, he had no choice. The road he was on ceased to exist. Okay, we're going to do this kind of fast. Motion to dismiss. Must you, as a judge, sign a motion to dismiss if one is presented to you? No, says Valdez. It's not a ministerial act that you're obligated to do, okay? You can say no. Now, it doesn't mean you're ever going to make your prosecutor prove the case or prove it up effectively, but in this case, the judge refused to sign the motion to dismiss, so the prosecutor tries to mandamus the judge into signing the motion to dismiss, unsuccessfully. More, this is a plea bargain case. Hey, judges, guess what? A plea bargain, I got 10 minutes, thanks. Okay, Eight, that'll work. Plea bargaining, you know, let's make sure we're clear on this. A case involving a plea bargain is when a defendant or defense lawyer negotiates a deal with the prosecutor and then comes before you and offers it. Okay? In this case, Mr. Moore had engaged in a true plea bargain with the defense, with the prosecution, and when it was brought to the judge, the judge accepted the plea bargain and then imposed additional terms on top of it. That's not a plea bargain, okay? That is not a plea bargain. The judge became an active party in the plea bargaining process. That's what this case says is a no-no. What can you do if you do not accept that plea bargain? You can say, I'm not willing to accept this plea bargain, and then you put the defendant right back to where he or she was to the point prior to when they were negotiating with the state. Now, sometimes y'all are going to reject it for reasons like, if I come to you as a prosecutor and I got a 20-year-old who's got a who's been accused of speeding, and I say, I want to recommend deferred disposition, special expense fee, that's it. Can you legally accept that plea deal? No, because if they're under 20 and it's an offense involving motor vehicle control, they have to take the driving safety course as a condition of deferred. Okay, what would be the appropriate move? Sorry, Mr. Turner, court can't accept that. I think you know why. If you don't, I'll tell you, state law requires that this person take a driving safety course. Push them back to where they were. Let them start over again and give them a chance to remedy it. But what this judge was doing was accepting, putting his or her own terms right on top of the plea bargain. Don't do that. Okay. Now, some of you only see prosecutors every blue moon. Okay. And keep in mind, too, that when a defendant comes into your court pro se and they plea out and they admit fault and then you all talk about the case and then you impose a deal, that's not, or you impose conditions, that's not what we're talking about here either. A plea bargain is when the state is an active party, not when someone's come in to fess out, you know, to plea out and then ask for mercy. Okay, that's different. Wilson is just an outrageous case. I had to mention it this year because it's a court of criminal appeals case in which, in a capital murder case, the police fabricated a police report to try to make a guy confess. And this violates the Texas exclusionary rule. I think it's ironic, but it's true. In Texas, cops can lie to you to make you confess, but they cannot create fictitious documents to make you confess. That's where we draw the line. Lying's okay as long as you don't create make-believe laboratory reports and things of that nature. Okay. Okay, directed verdict. This case, I think, was also one that really kind of upset a lot of prosecutors. It upsets me. I don't like the case, but I do understand what happened here. When is the proper time to make a directed verdict? Come on, someone tell me. Yeah, after the state rests, the state's going to rest, okay? And then you're taught that's your time to make, because they're done presenting evidence. Okay, this is what happens. State's presenting its case, but one of its witnesses is not there. Judge says, I know that your witness is not here and you're drawing this thing out. Defense lawyer hears the judge getting after the prosecutor and gets up there and says, Your Honor, I'm going to go ahead and make a motion for a directed verdict. Judge says, motion granted. Okay, now, the state had never rested. So the question then is, was that really a directed verdict or was that a dismissal? The state insisted that because they had not rested, that had to be treated as a dismissal and no jeopardy applied. Court of Criminal Appeals said, we would love to answer your question. The problem is we don't have any jurisdiction to answer your question because under our case law and under our statute, okay, a directed verdict is not a dismissal, and unless the legislature rewrites the law and gives us some way to give you, a prosecutor, some relief on this, there's nothing we can do. We don't have jurisdiction to hear this case. Judge Holcomb, who many of you all know, who's on the Court of Criminal Appeals, who just retired, dissented, saying this is the worst decision we've issued in a very long time because it effectively denies the state and the people of Texas to have their day in court for the benefit of overzealous judges and criminal defense lawyers. All right. Morales is a case that I want y'all to also, this is one I'd actually like you to read. Morales is a case that they had to do a motion for new trial. And in this motion for new trial, this is something I did not know. This is a Class C misdemeanor case that happened up in the Metroplex. And the judge, the guy had gotten stopped and arrested on traffic warrants. He had outstanding traffic warrants. The reason for the stop was he made an illegal U-turn. Once he's arrested, they also find drug paraphernalia in his car. What happens is at trial, the defense lawyer makes a motion that the state has to produce the arrest warrants that were used to arrest this defendant because that was the basis for the initial stop, okay? That was the basis of why they took him into custody and they found his drug paraphernalia. This is actually a drug paraphernalia case. The problem is the state wasn't prepared to do it, and the state didn't do it, and then they learned later that, guess what? Under those fact patterns, you actually are required to produce the actual warrants that gave rise. If that's the only reason why they arrested you, you do have to produce those arrest warrants when there's a motion to produce the arrest warrant. They make a motion for new trial. The judge ends up granting the motion for new trial, but ends up stating on the record, and this is a municipal court of record, I'm going to grant this motion for new trial because the evidence was legally insufficient. Judges, if you are in a court of record and you say that on the record, double jeopardy applies and you cannot, then the state cannot retry that case. And I know this is pretty complicated and I'm compressing it. It's the reason I want you to read this case. Ultimately, the Court of Appeals reversed the decision of the lower courts and found that because he actually could have been arrested because he made the illegal U-turn, that the whole thing about not producing warrants was not that big of a deal. Nevertheless, that was news to me. Okay, let me talk to you. We're going to do this, and then I'll close with some comments about children. Do your prosecutors have the ability to single out defendants and not give them a standard plea bargain deal? Absolutely, okay? This was a case involving a sitting public official. She didn't get the standard deal, and she was upset about it, okay? I like this case, too. This is a case out of Dallas. What do you do when a trial judge does something that's statutorily prohibited, like give a deferred adjudication to a DWI in a county court? Or in your case, giving deferred disposition to a CDL holder. What's the remedy? This case answers the question clearly. Mandamus. This is a case where a Dallas County judge gave deferred to a DWI, and that's not allowed under Texas law. What was the remedy for the prosecutor? Ask for the appellate court to mandamus the county judge to cease and desist, don't go forward because you can't. The same would be true for you. If any one of y'all tried to grant deferred to a CDL holder, and I was your prosecutor and I wanted to put a stop to it, the case explains exactly how I would go about doing it. Let's go ahead and close on this. A big theme that you're going to be hearing about from us is it looks like the pendulum is swinging the other way now about how do we treat children in municipal and justice courts. We're starting to have a little bit of an awakening that fining children is stupid. Maybe some of you have already figured this out on your own. Fines have been used historically for adults. It's an adult punishment. Children historically have never been sent to criminal court. They go to juvenile court. But our juvenile courts and our juvenile justice system is so broken that they can't handle the volume. So they have shifted these cases back onto us. Two cases this year, I think, are going to come back and are going to be something that we're going to hear about again. One of them is called Graham versus Florida, and it's a Supreme Court case. And in Graham versus Florida, the Supreme Court held that life sentences for children, someone who commits a heinous felony when they're like 16 years old, is unconstitutional because it violates the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. Here's the reason why. Because children, according to the Supreme Court, and I want to stress this to each and every one of you, have three times the diminished culpable mental state of adults. I don't know where they got three times. I don't know why they said four times. But this is a big deal because y'all are seeing kids accused of criminal conduct every day, and we tend to presume that the culpability of these kids is no different than the culpability of an adult. This case clearly says otherwise, okay? Regardless of the fact that they're talking about kids who are going away terms of incarceration. Here's another case I want to leave you with. It's called N. Ray B.W. In this case, a young girl was arrested for being a prostitute. It turns out she's like 14, 15 years old. And she is filed on in juvenile court for delinquent conduct, specifically prostitution. The Supreme Court of Texas, mind you, because this is even if the kid did something that if you or I did it, it would be criminal, those cases don't go to the Court of Criminal Appeals. Those cases end up going to the Texas Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said the purpose of our juvenile justice system is not to punish children in Texas. Okay? Well, they obviously don't know what's going on in municipal and justice courts. In fact, I can tell you after having met with the Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court, they really don't know what's going on in municipal and justice courts. And the other thing that they said in this case is that the purpose of our system, because of the fact that, one, she could have never consented to have sexual intercourse because of our statutory rape laws, and combined with the fact that the purposes of our juvenile justice system is to rehabilitate and not to punish children who get engaged in conduct that would otherwise be criminal if done by adults, that the finding that she engaged in delinquent conduct was illegal. Now, take these two cases together and file them in your mind. Go ahead and leave them in your mind for a second. Now, I think you're going to see clearly what's around the corner for us in municipal and justice courts. Because we continue to process more children, and we treat them as criminals without any consideration of their youth and the implications that it means to be a child, and we actually give them fewer due process protections than kids in juvenile courts do. And this session, there was an awakening. It began with Senator Whitmire, and it's not done. I mean, he's already made it clear to us there will be interim studies on all this, and y'all are going to hear more on it. And we'll talk more about it later. But these are the cases I will leave you with, and thank you very much. I'll talk to you later.